Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. Over the weekend, world leaders from some of the richest countries gathered at the G7 summit in England. Normally, it's an annual event, but in 2020, the raging coronavirus pandemic led President Trump initially to delay and then to cancel the summit. This year, the COVID-19 crisis had receded enough in the world's richest countries to allow the leaders of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US to meet together, in person and maskless. And spirits were high as Prime Minister Johnson and his wife Carrie welcomed President and First Lady Biden with smiles and elbow bumps. Now, this relative normalcy of G7 proceedings was set against the continuing reality of COVID's deadly impact on the rest of the world. The day before the summit began, India reported more than 6,000 deaths from the coronavirus, the world's most devastating daily mortality since the pandemic began. And this vast global disparity meant that COVID-19 was the top agenda item for the G7. President Biden held a news conference at the end of the summit, announcing a significant contribution by the United States to meet the G7's commitment to allocate 1 billion vaccine doses to poorer countries.
I committed that we would provide a half a billion beyond the 80 million we've already done, half a billion doses of Pfizer vaccine, which we contracted to pay for, in addition to money we put into the COVID project.
These commitments are important for battling COVID-19, but some are wondering if relying on the goodwill of richer nations is a sustainable long-term approach to global public health. Joining me now is Emily Rahala, who is staff writer for The Washington Post, covering foreign affairs and vaccine diplomacy. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, happy to be here.
Also with me is Tom Boyke, who is director of global health programs at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tom, so glad to have you today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Emily, I want to start with you. So the Biden administration pledged these 500 million doses to developing countries and helping to make sure that the G7 commitment of 1 billion gets done. Is this a big deal? Are these a lot of doses?
That's a great question. I think there's really two ways to look at it. First of all, yes, in one way, it is a very big deal. 500 million doses from the United States, plus hundreds of millions of other doses from partners. It's a lot of doses. And for each and every person who receives one of those doses, it's potentially life-saving. So yes, big deal. On the other hand, when we put those figures up against a broader picture of global need, both in the immediate short term and looking through to the middle term, next year, the year beyond that, it's a relatively modest figure. And it really shows how urgent the situation is in terms of global vaccination.
So I want to just follow on that with you, Emily, for a second, just to ask. So imagine we could just wave the magic wand. Just how many doses does the world need to beat COVID-19?
Sure. So the estimate that's typically floated from public health experts and organizations like the World Health Organization is that it's going to take something like 11 billion doses to get the world up to a reasonable standard of vaccination and have a chance of beating this thing back. So, you know, a lot of people recognize that that will take a while, but putting that 1 billion dose perspective, I think it is really important. It's a lot of doses. It will matter significantly to every person who gets one of those doses, but it's far short of what we're going to need over the next months and even through years.
Now, Tom, you wrote for The Atlantic back in March that in the fight against this disease, the powerful countries with the best access to vaccines have really kept the overwhelming number of available doses to themselves. Has this G7 pledge changed that pattern?
It has. It's at least a step in that direction. So for most of the 6 months that the global vaccination rollout has been happening, The countries that have been the largest donors have been China, India, although that has stopped now amidst its crisis, and to a much lesser extent, but still significant, Russia. Most democracies, wealthy democracies at least, weren't donating doses at all. The U.S. did loan doses to Mexico and China about a month ago, but this commitment of doses is really the first large commitment to start donating on behalf of these wealthy democracies.
So, Tom, I just find this fascinating. I feel like I haven't taken an IR class since grad school, but it was one of those rules, right? That democracies rarely go to war with each other. Like one of those things you just are supposed to take away. Is it also true then that democracies rarely help the rest of the world in the context of a global pandemic, or is this something distinct?
So I do think it's an interesting issue. It's it comes down in two ways. Wealthy democracies had committed cash. So COVAX, the multilateral initiative, is almost every large funder is a wealthy democracy. And that had been scheduled to distribute 2 billion doses this year. They are sadly far short of that goal, currently at 80 or so million doses distributed so far. But they were helping in that regard. And a lot of the global health infrastructure that'll distribute vaccines is funded by the US and other wealthy democracies. But in terms of sharing doses when they were scarce, it does appear that wealthy democracies had a hard time justifying to their public using doses abroad that could be used to satisfy needs at home. And that has remained true even as we've moved to less vulnerable populations like adolescents.
So, Emily, let's go to, Tom was just talking a little bit there about the COVAX initiative. Can you help us to understand a little bit more about what it is and where it currently stands?
Sure. So COVAX is the multilateral system's answer to this crisis. And it started to get underway even last summer, well before there were, you know, viable coronavirus vaccines. And the idea was, let's pool our resources. Instead of competing against each other for supply, let's pool our resources, negotiate with vaccine makers together, and then equitably split the results, with an eye to getting vaccines everywhere. A very good and noble idea. What happened instead, as Tom has mentioned, was that wealthy countries pledged money and support to this initiative, but at the same time, they really cut side deals directly with drug makers. So you had countries like the United States, Canada, buying huge amounts of the projected supply for most of the vaccines ahead of time, well before they were even approved for emergency use. And what that really undermined this collective effort, because you had the richest countries in the world competing against this WHO-backed multilateral effort for the same doses. COVAX fate took another blow more recently with the crisis in India. A lot of the doses that COVAX said it would deliver were going to be made in India. And those doses, the delivery of those doses has been slowed a lot down because of the crisis there. So what we've seen is this, what's seen as sort of the best hope, or what had been seen as the best hope for low and middle income countries, has really struggled to get off the ground. And the consequences of that have been quite dire, and could indeed be dire going into the months ahead.
So it's worth noting, Tom, that during the G7, one of the other big sort of agenda items was China and the idea of sort of marginalizing China a bit on the global stage. But I'm wondering, if we come back to the vaccine piece, what role China is currently playing relative to distributing these excess vaccines, and if they're doing better than these rich democracies have been doing up to this point.
So China has been donating doses, not huge amounts of doses, ultimately. The vast majority of the vaccines that have left China have been commercial sales, exports, countries buying them from producers in China. But China has donated roughly 40 million doses on top of that, I think, at this point. They've pledged more, but not a lot of them haven't left the country as they've focused on their own domestic vaccination program. Those doses, despite China's protestations otherwise, have largely gone to trading partners and strategic interests. So all but two of the countries that have received donations of vaccines from China are Belt and Road Initiative countries. So countries that are participating in, you know, economic development and partnership programs with China. What the G7 did this week, in addition to committing significantly more doses than China had, they also, those leaders have articulated a different way of proceeding with vaccines. They have indicated that they won't be traded for political favors and they will follow the public health data. That part remains to be seen. They've committed to work with COVAX on how those distributions of vaccines occur, but we don't know as of yet where these 1 billion doses that the G7 committed this week will actually go.
So I'm so appreciative of the way you kind of laid that out for us, Tom. Emily, it does feel to me like the sort of naked politics are visible in that sort of exporting or even in donating to strategic partners, but there's always politics, right? Those are sort of a given. And so I'm wondering in the context of the G7 nations, what that politics or diplomacy looks like. Is it rivalry between the nations? Is it posturing? Or is there a genuinely politics-free collaborative effort happening here?
You know, there's very much politics at play. One of the things that's been really interesting for me to watch over the last few months to start is how the Biden administration talks about this. You know, Biden comes to office wanting to restore America's role in the multilateral system, work collaboratively with allies. At the same time, there are a lot of voices within his administration saying, we have to do more to compete with China, to counter China's overtures on the world stage. And in the administration's early vaccine efforts, we really see them sort of trying to feel their way in terms of how do we give these doses away. So in one of the initial announcements, we said, okay, 75% to COVAX, 25% based on need, and we're also going to do our neighbors. And you can see them sort of trying to figure out whether they want to play that, you know, hard politics, interest-based game, or commit to the multilateral approach. In terms of the U.S. interactions with the G7, you know, there's definitely a split. I would say right now the split in terms of the vision for vaccine diplomacy has the most to do with how well the domestic vaccination campaign is going. So the U.S. and the U.K., who have vaccinated a lot of people at home, are feeling the most generous, and countries that have had less successful campaigns so far are more hesitant.
So, Tom, let's talk about how it happens. How do we, in fact, get the shots into arms? It's one thing to pledge the doses. It's another thing to make it happen.
That's right. So one helpful way to think about this is there are really three constraints on how quickly vaccination happens, both domestically and globally. There are supply constraints. Do you have enough vaccines? There are administration constraints. Can you actually deliver them into arms? And there are demand constraints. Do people want to take them? We've seen that at play domestically. We're about to see it globally. So what we've been talking about in terms of donations is addressing that supply constraint. And there, the US has indicated, and I think they will probably be the fastest, that these doses will start to roll out in August. Now, these are additional to the smaller donations the U.S. had indicated would happen in June. So the U.S. is scheduled to start to donate 25 million doses in June. Now the challenge will be, can we actually distribute these in countries that have limited vaccination infrastructure? Keep in mind, most of these, I mean, these doses are going to go to adults. So that is not what global vaccination programs are set up to do. By and large, we vaccinate children in global health, not so much adults. So this will be a challenge. And then there's the question in some countries about the vaccine hesitancy issues, which are not as palpable as they are in the US, but they are real. And particularly with increasing adoption of social media around the world, something that will also have to be addressed to ensure that we can get the uptake that we need.
So, Emily, I'm wondering about the geography of this. Where will the vaccines go first? You mentioned India earlier, and obviously Japan, which is itself a G7. But given the nature of the Olympics there, I'm just wondering where on the map we're going to see this start happening.
Well, that's a great question. It's a question that I don't necessarily have an answer to yet, because the messaging that we saw coming out of the G7 was not very particular on that point. the debate seems to be among the rich countries is, how do we distribute this? Do we go through COVAX, which promises every participating country an equal share regardless of need? So a country like, say, Canada, that is relatively wealthy and does have access to vaccines, is also participating in COVAX, for instance. Or do we somehow earmark these doses for the countries in the greatest need? And there's a pretty robust debate, I think, within the G7 countries, also within the public health world. I know this is something that Tom has written about what is the most effective and what is the most ethical way to decide who gets what when. And that is not clear to me at this point.
So, Tom, that's exactly where I wanted to go next. Obviously, the president there was saying that part of this is to put together a mechanism to anticipate and deal with the next pandemic. And your point that we've had success globally in vaccination, but of children. So is this model of hoping that the wealthy nations will either through their own political or existential interest be sure to, you know, contribute to poorer nations, is that the model going forward? Or is there some other set of structures we should be implementing?
Great question. So there are really two issues here. One is production and one is how we're going to allocate these particular donations. On the production side, right now, 9 countries have administered three out of every 4 doses that have gone out in the first 6 months of this vaccine rollout. Those countries are by and large the same countries making them. And it's understandable that countries that are producing vaccines would want to prioritize the needs of their own population. It is equally understandable that every other country would love to be in the same position. And after experiencing this pandemic, it's not going to be acceptable for countries to be without production, at least regionally. So a big push will be, how do we set up regional centers of manufacturing? So in the future, you don't have such a small number of countries monopolizing vaccine production so that every other country needs to wait. The second issue that Emily raised, though, that I just want to quickly flag, is around, how are we going to distribute these doses? Is it going to be done by population, or is it going to be done about current risk? We did put a piece out in The Lancet last week. I do think it's pretty clear where the areas of greatest risk are going to be in the next 12 weeks. And the question is, can countries direct doses, at least initially, there first, because the goal of vaccination really should ultimately be about preventing premature death. And given scarce resources, we have to make sure we're marshaling vaccines to go to the settings where that public health gain is possible.
So, Emily, if I'm a listener in a state where we're up to 60%, you know, vaccination of adults, I've taken off my mask, I'm about to have hot girl summer, why should I care whether or not India or South American nations end up with vaccines?
It's a great question. I think it gets to the heart of this issue and the hesitancy of rich countries so far to share. I think there's clearly an ethical case. Beyond that, it's a very practical case. Everyone wants this to be over. Everyone wants to move on. But until people everywhere are vaccinated, the coronavirus is going to continue to circulate. It's going to have lots of chances to mutate, and it's going to keep spreading. And we'll have to see how well the vaccines hold up against future versions of this virus. We'll have to wait for the global economy to recover. And basically, this disaster that everyone wants to be over is not going to end until everyone is vaccinated.
Vaccine equity is not just philanthropic, it is self-interested. Emily Rahala is staff writer for The Washington Post, covering foreign affairs and vaccine diplomacy. And Tom Boyke is senior fellow for the Global Health Economics and Development and director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now that was a group of performers in a 1930s era newsreel singing about a New Deal program that employed theater artists during the Great Depression. Under the Works Progress Administration of Franklin Roosevelt's administration, over 10,000 artists from a range of disciplines were paid by the federal government to create work for the public. Now, the economic devastation of the pandemic has led cities to create their own kind of New Deal-inspired programs for today's artists. Last week, New York City began taking applications for its Artist Corps, which Mayor Bill de Blasio announced last month.
As part of the comeback in New York City, we're investing $25 million to employ over 1,500 artists to help bring back arts and culture all over New York City. We're going to hire artists, musicians, performers. They're going to be out in communities doing public art, public performances, pop-up shows through the Summer Rising program, so many different elements at the grassroots, creating murals, you name it. We want to give artists opportunity, and we want the city to feel the power of our cultural community again.
And while New York City's program involves one-time grants, St. Paul, Minnesota, and San Francisco, California, have rolled out guaranteed minimum income programs for artists that give out monthly, no-strings-attached payments. And both programs primarily were intended to support artists of color. We're starting out in St. Paul, where the nonprofit Springboard for the Arts partnered earlier this year with city government to deliver monthly payments to 25 local artists. Caroline Taiwo is the Economic Opportunity Director for Springboard for the Arts, and she joins me now. Caroline, it's so lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So why guaranteed income for artists?
That's the big question. The pandemic has been devastating to individual artists. It's exposed how fragile artists' livelihoods are and how much our economy relies on gig work and independent workers who have no safety net. This includes a lot of artists. Springboard spent the last year doing emergency relief work and also helping artists respond to the needs of their communities, like dealing with social isolation. We knew that the emergency relief work was really important, but it also is not a systemic solution. So we started looking for ways we could work with other folks who are trying to change economic systems. And we were inspired by Mayors for Guaranteed Income, that network, and the citywide pilot happening in our hometown of St. Paul when we started our guaranteed income pilot for artists in our neighborhood.
So when you talk about artists responding to the need of the community, and we're talking here about St. Paul, I have to think that a core need of that community is addressing the racial pain that has been so central to that community and to our whole nation since Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. What have your city's artists been doing around addressing that?
Minneapolis and St. Paul have been rocked by the past year of multiple pandemics, and we want our artists to be a part of the movement, especially around guaranteed income and economic justice. We want artists to be included as participants, and we also think there's a lot of potential for how artists can contribute to these movements by helping to tell the story of the impact and by helping people see the possibility of things like economic justice. Artists provide a lot of benefits to communities that aren't always monetary, and that includes meaning making, social connection, cultural preservation, and education. The list there is endless.
So talk to me about how artists were chosen, given that they do all of this different kind of work and they do it in so many different media.
We started by looking at our list of emergency relief fund recipients from over the past year, since those were artists who'd already reached out with a COVID-related need. That list was very long, of course, and we had a limited amount of funding. So we decided to narrow our scope and pilot with artists in the Rondo and Frogtown neighborhoods. Springboards had a long relationship with these neighborhoods. Springboards been in St. Paul for over 30 years, and 3 years ago, we acquired a used car dealership here in the neighborhood that we're turning into an arts and community space. We focus our pilot in the Rondo and Frogtown neighborhoods because we recognize the disproportionate economic effects of COVID over the past year and the legacy of displacement and divestment from those communities over decades.
So last week, we talked with Aisha Yanduro, who does a guaranteed income program in Mississippi. And she's been winning me over for sure on the value of a guaranteed income program, as opposed to, for example, paying for the art to get done, right? But rather paying artists. So talk to me about why the guaranteed income is kind of a different approach and the value that it might have, maybe particularly for artists.
Yeah, one of the things that's most attractive to us about guaranteed income is that it isn't a competitive program. Many times, especially for artists, competitive programs are extractive and really rely on false ideas about bootstraps and meritocracies. And we've turned the idea of being an artist into something that's a lot of people feel like is a privilege rather than a right. We know cash works. The research from Stockton and other pilots has shown that giving people flexible capital actually helps them get and retain better paying jobs and make better, more relevant decisions about their lives. But what I try to remind folks as I'm talking about our program and programs like guaranteed income around the country are they're all pilots. And the point is for them to generate learning and put pressure on government and other large systems to step up and do guaranteed income themselves, and not that a small nonprofit or a city government will be able to make this a long-term or program that will serve at scale.
Caroline Taiwo is the Economic Opportunity Director for Springboard for the Arts. Caroline, thanks so much.
Melissa, thanks for having me.
Now we're going to San Francisco. Last month, the city began delivering monthly payments to 130 local artists. But while the program was intended to support marginalized artists, many local organizations centered around people of color say the rollout has been rushed and poorly executed. Chief among their criticisms is that the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which is tasked with administering the program, is not itself devoted primarily to artists of color. To learn more about why some of the members of the community are speaking out against the way the program has been implemented, I spoke with T. Kibo Drew, Managing Director of the Queer Women of Color Media Arts Project, which is based in San Francisco.
So we have inequity going into the process, which means we have inequity coming out of the process. The money should have gone to Black, Native American, other people of color, Asian, Latinx artists, et cetera. Very early on in this process, the entire zip code of Chinatown was left out. And it took the community
What?
Exactly. So Yerba Buena decided that only certain zip codes would be eligible for this grant. Initially, they left out the entire zip code in which Chinatown is. It took community members saying, wait a minute, there are artists in Chinatown and arts organizations in Chinatown, and you need to include Chinatown in the grant program so that those artists are eligible to apply to the program. So from the very beginning, it was inequitable because it doesn't cover the entire city, only certain zip codes.
Okay, so we've been pretty critical here, but I want to pause for a second because you do think the idea is a good idea, is that right?
It's a great idea, especially to have Black, Native American, people of color artists receiving a guaranteed basic income. They have been dramatically and drastically affected by COVID, either by being laid off from large arts organizations or those of them who are working in hospitality who've lost their secondary source of income. And the other thing about it is we don't talk often enough about the fact that most artists of color, so Black filmmakers, Native American filmmakers, Latina, Asian, Pacific Islander, are actually pushed out of art because they don't have the money to continue.
So if this is a good idea in theory, but in practice, we're having some challenges. My understanding is that the San Francisco Guaranteed Income for Artists program actually received a new infusion of funds from Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey. So given that that's going to extend the program a bit, is it possible to intervene now to make it more equitable?
It is possible to intervene. It would take a great deal of willingness and also expertise and consultation and actually Yerba Buena implementing the suggestions of the community and really understanding them. It will probably take them longer to understand equity than getting these grants out, because really, it's a case of might makes right. They have the money, they got more money, so now we're trying to fix something that was inequitable from the beginning. And that's much harder to do than to actually sit down and really contemplate what it would take for it to be equitable. And one of the main points is that the fact that Yerba Buena is a white-led organization, and initially these dollars were designed to go to people of color communities, not just the artists, but the organizations. So basically what's happening is they're outsourcing equity, don't have expertise or experience in equity, and it's not being invested into the community in the way that it should have been.
So there are a couple of other cities that are beginning to think about programs like this. Do you have advice? I mean, I almost feel like I should say, don't give folks advice for free. Do you have a consulting fee you would like to charge for that advice? But since it's going to be free, is there something you'd like to share around advice for those cities?
Well, my organization does do consulting, so that is a possibility.
Listen, intellectual labor is labor.
Right, exactly. But I think the advice is, if you're going to invest in people of color communities, then you really need to invest in people of color communities. You don't need to incentivize white-led organizations to do equity, which is something that the head of Yerba Buena actually said. You really need to give that investment and building up the capacity of those organizations and those communities to do the work. And I just want to say, it is much easier for us to figure out finances and fundraising and development and all of those things than it is to gain knowledge and equity. We don't treat equity like a hard skill, and it is.
Very last question. This might be an opportunity for us to rethink the role and responsibility of all of us and of government and of our communities towards investment in the arts. If it is, what would be your sort of best case hope or scenario to come out of this pandemic moment relative to how we think about our public investment in the arts?
Ooh, that's such a big question. And there are a lot of ways.
Yeah, you got 32 seconds. No, right? I'm just kidding. You can take
It's a huge question. I mean, first off, I have to say that communities of color, Black, Native American, other folks of color, the way we look at arts and culture is vastly different than how it's perceived of in mainstream society. We look at arts and culture as a part of who we are, as part of reclamation, as part of recovery, as part of healing. So there's a deeper piece for arts and culture to us. I think about, you know, the African-American Arts and Cultural Center. I think about the Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center, the American Indian Cultural District here in San Francisco. There is a way that they are connecting communities to arts and culture that is really powerful. And as the writer Jewel Gomez said, you have to be able to imagine a better world to get to a better world. And I think that's the role of art and artists within community, and that's something that we need to invest in. Arts are very much a part of democracy, which is another reason to invest in the arts. And I think the status quo got us here. The status quo won't get us out of here. And so we need to look at different ways in which we can move forward. And I think the arts and culture are very much a part of that. Even in my own work, we end up doing a lot of healing and trauma work in film, and we know that's a part of what we do. So we have crisis counselors and mental health practitioners to kind of help us deal with generational trauma from white supremacy and racism and all of the isms so that we can move forward. And that is something really, really powerful about the arts that we don't see when we consider them to be a luxury for those who have the means.
T. Kibo-Drew is the managing director of the Queer Women of Color Media Arts Project based in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Really enjoyed talking to you today.
And we reached out to the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, but we haven't received a comment yet on this story. We'll post one online at thetakeaway.org if we do hear back. On Sunday night, a Pekingese named Wasabi was crowned best in show at the 145th annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. I watched the show with my three ragtag mutts, but joining me now is Sarah Montague, the Takeaway's resident Westminster reporter. Sarah, I'm thrilled to have you here, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. This is my annual treat.
Well, I was thrilled to know that I would be guest hosting for this segment. So let's talk about Wasabi, who was awarded Best in Show last night.
Wasabi is an extraordinarily beautiful Pekingese. He is co-owned by a syndicate, including Sandra Middlebanks, David Fitzpatrick, his handler and breeder, Peggy Steinman, and the late Iris Love, one of New York's most irrepressible, fabulous characters. She died of COVID last March, and her New York Times obituary called her the Indiana Jones in miniskirt, which tells you something about her. So in some ways, what it felt like last night was a memorial to Iris. But you might want to hear from David about what makes Wasabi special.
He's just a fantastic dog. I've been breeding Pekingese for 50 years, and he conforms to the breed standard, and he also has charisma. You know, he's just a terrific dog.
Best in Show judge Patricia Trotter reinforced that. She said he was a dog who thought he was 10 feet tall and behaved like a lion. They are, in fact, called the lion dog. What he actually looks like is a flower in a sea of his own fur with this fabulously expressive face.
He truly has a fabulously expressive face. And yet that sea of fur, I kept saying to myself, is there a dog in there? Like, how big is the dog itself as compared to that fabulous mane of fur that we were seeing last night?
That's a really good question, because when the judges judge, and they judge big dogs like that, the winner of the herding group was an old English sheepdog, and it's much the same. They actually feel right under the fur, the hair and coat, for the skin structure, for the bone structure. They need to know what the substance is there. And she was saying he was perfectly constructed for a Pekingese. The big expressive head, the sloping body that gives them that waddling gait that's so delicious. They feel for that quite literally to be sure it's all there.
Oh, I love that. So there were some new elements this year. Certainly part of it was the location, but can you walk us through some of the other changes and what effect they had on the show?
That was really the most significant change. The show, in fact, did take place at its usual time in February of 2020. Almost immediately after that, the world shut up, and Westminster came to the conclusion fairly quickly, given the tremendous uncertainty at the time, that they couldn't imagine that they were going to confidently be able to come back to the very crowded circumstances of the pier and then at Madison Square Garden. They reached out to a number of different facilities, I understand, and they happened on Lyndhurst because it itself, the estate is in Terrytown. It is the result of three generations of robber barons flaunting their wealth in a neo-Gothic style, first built in 1838. And it had had for many years the Westchester Kennel Club Dog Show. So it had a history with that. And it had a history with that because its last owner, Helen Gould, daughter of the financier Jay Gould, was a peak fancier. So when I spoke to David Fitzpatrick earlier, he said, well, that has to be a good omen. And so it proved.
When you talk about that sense of accessibility, does the annual winner of this show impact the adoption of family pets? In other words, will we see an uptick in requests for Pekingese pups this year?
Happily, no. That doesn't happen as much as you think, and it doesn't happen under other conditions either. The year that President Obama got a Portuguese water dog, everybody thought it would happen then. The community is much more measured and responsible, so they spend a lot of time. One of the reasons Westminster is a bench show is so that people can go and get a look at what they're interested in, and then there are constant messages saying, Think about the dog that is right for your lifestyle. This is going to be a member of your family. Patricia Trotter, the judge, had a great speech before she awarded the awards last night, and she said, the thing to remember is not every pet is a show dog, but every show dog is a pet. And that's how they message. The Peaks are relatively popular anyway. They're small, they're charming, they work well in apartments. So my guess is that in AK registrations, they are probably fairly high up the list. But no, people don't rush to get one of those, which is a good thing.
Let's talk about Verb. That was the Border Collie who won the agility championship again this year, also won back in 2019. And I have to say, as someone who has sort of a crew of ruffian mutts in my home who nonetheless are quite athletic, I really love the agility aspect. How is this relatively new addition from 2014, how has it impacted the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show more broadly?
I think one of the reasons they incorporated that, there's also an obedience competition, is in fact precisely to broaden access. One of the things that distinguishes it, of course, is Westminster is a confirmation show. It celebrates the extraordinary beauty of purebreds. But many other kinds of wonderful dogs are out there, and both Patricia Trotter in her speech last night mentioned that, and it's part of the tradition of Helen Gould, who was one of the country's most significant philanthropists, and while she had purebred Peaks and her brother showed St. Bernards and they were very successful, she had many, many strays. What's called the All-American Dog, mixed breeds, can compete in agility, so it's a wonderful way of opening the community of dogs and also to people who want to celebrate an active dog. It really is quite sensational to watch.
It is stunning to watch. Sarah Montague is the Takeaway's resident Westminster reporter. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
And while most of us probably don't have a best in show, award-winning dog, cat, or chicken, doesn't mean we don't love our pets. And for many of you out there, the pandemic actually inspired you to adopt.
Hi, this is Carrie. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. I am so happy that I got my dog, Leo. I had been wanting a dog for about 15 years, and the pandemic pushed me to do something I always wanted to do. I made up tons of excuses, and I was super anxious the day I adopted him. But by the second day of having him, I knew it was all over. He's a small terrier mix, and he's just given me something to take care of outside of myself, and that's been a lifesaver during this time.
Hi, this is Dave Snyder from Richfield, and I'm calling in about Luke, the Bernese Mountain Dog, who was our pandemic pup. Luke was going to be the family dog, but after I spent several weeks sleeping on the floor of my daughter's room with him as a tiny little puppy, going out with him every couple of hours through the night, walking him every morning, he became, for the first time ever in my life, my dog. And we still walk every morning, and as the apple tree in our backyard grew, he would help me to pick the apples after our morning walk, and then I could bring him to friends. And he helped me meet my best neighbor friends, Rebecca and Joe, and their husky puppy, Gus. Luke now has a play date every morning with Gus and follows me from room to room, and he's absolutely delightful.
This is Jack Beal from Colorado Springs. Yes, we rescued a dog from Texas last year, and he's been a good addition to the company. He's very popular in the neighborhood.
Keep the calls coming. Leave us a voicemail at 877-869-8253 or send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. That's all we have for y'all today. As always, we appreciate you tuning in. And of course, call us with show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.